calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Yep, and every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his meds. Welcome back. Or welcome. Good morning, turn. Good afternoon, or whatever it may be, wherever you are. And happy first day of Hanukkah, Shabbat Shalom, TGIF. Happy Friday. The political lesson of Watergate, our quote for the day, is this. Never again must America allow an arrogant elite guard of political adolescents to bypass the regular party organization and dictate the terms of a national election. That quote for the day from Gerald R. Ford, Republican President of the United States. Brilliantly well said. And the transition from a group of arrogant elite political adolescents to the adults seems to be happening in Congress. Bernie Sanders, part of that transition, will be serving in the United States Senate beginning in January. Vermont Congressman at this moment, Bernie Sanders, Senator-elect Bernie Sanders. It's Friday, the first hour of our Friday program for pushing 3 years now, has always been Bernie, and it's time for our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders, the only independent, well, you'll be one of two independents in the Senate, but I think of you as America's congressman, neither a Democrat or Republican, and you tell the story straight. Bernie, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom, and let me again thank the many, many thousands of people, tens of thousands of people all over the United States of America who helped make our victory possible, and we really appreciate it.
Well, and we really appreciate you coming on the program and talking with us and just being willing to answer any question people put to you. I have very, very few politicians on this program because so many of them, there are so many areas where I know that, you know, I just can't ask that question because they don't want to go there. And you're a stand-up guy, and I appreciate it. The progressive agenda. Is there a difference between the progressive agenda and the Democratic agenda?
Yeah, there sure is. And here's what I want to say, and I want to make it as clear as I possibly can. November 7th, Election Day, was a great day for America in the sense that I think we ended, the American people said, we cannot continue going forward with right-wing extremism and a Bush-Cheney Republican leadership, which so clearly favored the wealthy and the powerful, over the middle class and working families, had total contempt for environmental efforts to deal with global warming or diseases caused by environmental degradation, the war in Iraq, the whole bit. So that is extremely important. I think it's fair to say we have stopped right-wing extremism. But, Tom, that is only half of the battle. The other half is what does the new leadership do, understanding that it is a very thin, perilously thin majority in the Senate, understanding that it takes 60 votes to overcome a filibuster. What is the agenda, what should be the agenda of the American people, of the middle class, those of us concerned about the environment, concerned about the war in Iraq? How do we move forward? What should we do, and then how do we do it? And in terms of how we do it, what I have to reiterate, it's a point that I've made many times on this program, is we need people throughout this country to understand that politics did not end on Election Day. You have got to continue to be active in the political process. You've got to push the leadership of this country in the House and the Senate to go forward in a progressive way, because on Capitol Hill, you have just thousands of extremely well-paid lobbyists who represent the oil companies, they represent the pharmaceutical industry, they represent the defense companies, and these guys have access, they're former leaders of the Republican Democratic Party, they have access onto Capitol Hill, they make huge campaign contributions. And if we're going to move America in a really different direction to represent the needs of all people rather than the wealthy and the powerful, ordinary Americans in all 50 states are going to have to be actively involved in the political process. So having said that, to my mind, what are some of the areas that we want to focus on? Well, I think in terms of health care, almost all of us know that our current system is the most wasteful, bureaucratic in the industrialized world, costs far more per capita than any other nation, and that we need to move toward a national health care program guaranteeing health care to all people. How do we do it? Big debate on that. By keeping our eyes on the prize, that health care should be a right of the American people, that we can do it in a cost-effective way, clearly has got to be a goal.
A right and not a privilege.
Exactly. Are there many people in Congress who talk about that? Frankly, not a whole lot. Not a whole lot. So there'll be incremental efforts here and incremental efforts there, some of which may in fact be very important and good. But making the fight to say, excuse me, we need a health care infrastructure in America by which every American can gain access regardless of income, good quality care. Can we do it? Damn right, we can do it. But it is going to take tremendous grassroots effort to take on the drug companies, who are the greediest and most powerful lobby on Washington, take on the insurance companies, take on the medical equipment suppliers who want to supply every, you know, fancy contraption to every hospital in America, driving up costs. Take a lot of work to do that, okay? That's one area. The economy. What's the issue in the economy? George Bush, probably alone in America, thinks the economy is doing great. And his confusion rests with the fact that it is doing great for the wealthiest people in this country. What's the problem, and how do we address it? The problem is that new jobs that are being created, especially in rural areas like the state of Vermont, often pay a lot less in wages and benefits than the jobs that we are losing. So while unemployment, of course, remains too high, the real problem is the middle class is shrinking because the real wages that American workers receive today are in many ways lower than they were 20 or 25 years ago. How do we create good-paying jobs in America? Well, to do that, you have to deal with many of the phenomenon of globalization, our disastrous trade policies that corporate America pushed on the Congress, NAFTA, permanent normal trade relations with China. How do you get corporate America to reinvest in America? How do we rebuild our manufacturing base? How do we stem the loss of millions of good information technology jobs? So that is a huge issue, but it's not just. The Democratic leadership, appropriately enough, is talking about raising the absurdly low minimum wage of $5.15 an hour. Is that right? Of course it's right. But we've got to go a lot further than that. There is not a lot of discussion in the leadership. There are individuals, Byron Dorgan, Sherrod Brown, others, myself, will be talking about trade policy. People in the House will be doing it. We are at this point in the minority. So we need a lot of support from people, and the media is 90% against us on this issue.
I find it interesting that Lou Dobbs, who proudly proclaims that he's a Republican, yes, is with you and me on this, yes, on this issue.
Lou is one, and, you know, and I have differences with Lou on some issues as well. But Lou Dobbs has been certainly the preeminent media person who's saying the middle class is collapsing. Our trade policies are one of the reasons for that. And he's right. Absolutely. And I've, you know, been on Lou Dobbs' show a number of times.
Yeah.
But if you look at the editorial pages, New York Times, Washington Post, if you look at Wall Street Journal, for sure, these guys believe in a trade policy which says that isn't it wonderful that American companies can throw American workers out on the street, move to China, and pay people their 30 cents an hour.
Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it is a huge and complicated issue, not easily solved, but we have got to delve into a number of things that we can do. Bottom line is that if we do not change our trade policies, in my view, our kids will have a lower standard of living than we do, and the gap between the rich and the poor will grow even wider. So that whole issue, and I'm just giving an overview of it, is an issue that we've got to jump into. You're going to have to take on a lot of big moneyed interest to do that. We need the support of the working families of America to help us do that. Environment, huge issue. Again, the issue of global warming, an issue that Bush and the Republican leadership, not only are they not addressing, I mean, even more pathetically, they are refusing even to acknowledge. That's the bad news. The good news is that there are people like Barbara Boxer, who will now be the chair of the Environmental Committee, and I'll be serving on her committee, do understand that global warming is real and frightening for the future of this country. And the other good news is that the technologies are now coming to life, are there, that can help us address this problem. That means raising CAFE standards, having vehicles that get far better mileage per gallon than is currently the case. We've been stagnant in that area for the last many, many years. It means big-time energy efficiency in terms of not only our transportation system, but in terms of our appliances, in terms of housing standards, in terms of new housing construction, as well as retrofitting older houses. We can make huge progress on weatherization and energy efficiency, and also, of course, moving toward sustainable energy. I think that is one of the most exciting areas out there because the technology is now there for wind, for solar, for biomass. In Vermont, many of our family farmers are struggling with very low dairy prices. And we think that there is more study needs to be done. But certainly we think that there is an opportunity for farmers to gain substantial income as we grow biofuels using wood appropriately, which we are doing in Vermont to some degree. More can be done. Geothermal power, a lot of potential out there to move this country away from fossil fuels and polluting energy sources.
And Burlington is producing electricity with a wood-fired plant.
Now, when I was mayor, we built that plant, and it's working well.
Yeah. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders, soon to be Senator, now Senator, I guess Senator-elect Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. We'll take your calls after this, 866-440-THOM, on the Tom Hartman Program. And welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Bernie Sanders, now Senator-elect Bernie Sanders, with us on the line, taking your calls, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you're up with Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, Senator Sanders. Hello, Tom. Yes, Senator Sanders, this is very serious time. I believe America's democracy is on the ropes. My question is to you. I'm 61. I remember Watergate very well. Now, while it's true that the war in Iraq has cast this terrible pall over America, the question I have, the central question to me is, if George Bush and or Dick Cheney has broken the law, I feel the most important priority for America is, at the minimum, to have an impeachment inquiry. I'd like your views on it.
Well, I think the most important thing that we can do with regard to that is to understand what they knew and when they knew it. And I think that there have got to be very vigorous investigations on many issues. Clearly, one of the very positive results of the November 7th election is that Congress will cease being a rubber stamp for the Bush administration. And a lot of questions, investigations, hearings will take place that have never taken place before. Certainly, at the very top of the list is why we went into Iraq in the first place, and what the president knew and when he knew it. I think that that is extremely important. I think you can go on from there. But I think also, in terms of restoring the faith of the American people in their government, one of the things that we've got to do is begin to deliver for the American people. So I think while you want to investigate, while you want to understand what Bush knew and go from there based on what the results of those investigations are, what you also want to do is make sure that the American people have decent paying jobs, that they have health care, that we turn around global warming. That, in fact, you restore the faith of the American people in the political process by showing them that government can work for all of the people rather than just the wealthy and the powerful.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have three or four calls here that have impeachment on the board. I just to cut right to the point, Bernie, is it your opinion that if investigations, and that's the if that was in Gary's question as well, if investigations done by Congress demonstrate clearly and irrefutably that George Bush or Dick Cheney or any other officials and high officials in government have committed high crimes and misdemeanors, should they be held accountable?
Well, that's what our Constitution speaks to, and I think we follow our Constitution. Yeah. Okay. So that's obvious. I mean, I think that's what should happen if that's where it is led. But here's what does concern me, Tom. While the middle class shrinks, while poverty increases, while working class families can't send their kids to college, you can't ignore those issues as well.
Right.
And one of the things that happens, especially among, you know, many progressives, they get hung up on an issue, and they're forgetting about the needs of their neighbors who are not staying up nights worrying about impeachment, but worrying about whether they're going to have a job, whether they can feed their kids. And to the degree that you ignore those issues, you are not going to have the kind of political movement and the kind of change that we need as a nation.
Yeah, well, hopefully we can walk and chew gum at the same time.
That's right. That's
okay.
Exactly correct.
Paul in Turnersville, Massachusetts. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Bernie and Tom. I think there's, I really appreciated your introductory points, Bernie. There's something that I think underlies all of the plans that we can make with a change in the Congress, and that's to try to restore the sense that we can talk with each other in a meaningful way without kind of polarizing all the conversations. It seems like this administration has created good guys and bad guys, has eliminated the individual from the conversation, and has totally eliminated dialogue as a way of learning learning how we can move forward from each other. You get one point of view, and we stick with that. We don't listen to anybody else. We're not going to get anywhere.
Well, I think that's a very good point. I mean, the idea that if you question the war in Iraq, you're somehow sympathetic to terrorists is a horrendous statement or a horrendous position, which the Bush administration continues to make. This world is complicated. There are honest people who have different points of view, and it is awful for the President of the United States to be dividing us in the way that he divides us. But it's not only that. It is a media which refuses to focus on the real issues facing the American people. And as I've mentioned many, many times, when we talk about political issues and when we talk about how we go forward as a nation, we have got to put pressure on the corporate media to talk about the real issues facing ordinary Americans.
Yeah, and deal also with the corporate media as the corporate media. I mean,
that's right.
Time for a new Sherman Trust Antitrust Act or something like
that.
We
need some. There's going to be a big conference in Memphis, Tennessee. I think January 11th through 13th. Thousands of people are going to be there, and I think we need to elevate the debate about media and whether media in America today is doing the kind of job that we need if we're serious about having a vibrant democracy.
It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Bernie Sanders with us. 1-866-440-8466. The Tom Hartman radio program, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting. We'll be back right after this break, 27 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Talk radio for the rest of us. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment, the first hour of every Friday for going on 3 years now. Congressman Bernie Sanders, Senator-elect Bernie Sanders. Bernie, it's going to take me a while. Stop saying, it's Congressman Bernie Sanders. We are so proud of you. Anyway, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And John in Los Angeles listening on KTLK. Hey, John.
Good morning, Tom. Good morning, Bernie. The question I'd like to ask you is, Tom is really the only one that's been hitting on this in the media. That's the attorneys, basically DuPont, farming out these attorneys to India, and you don't even hear the attorneys or the Bar Association outraged or anything about this. And I'm wondering if there's any talk about antitrust laws or Sherman trust laws coming back into the to be approved, because I mean, I'm not really skeptical. I'm not really believing in the Democrats, because we've got too many Rahm Emanuels and stuff that are in there, and you've got a few good people that are really for the American people, like Howard Dean, I think, is one of those. And just wondering what is really going to happen with these big corporations, because I think we're more and more a third world country as I see things happen.
Yeah, DuPont just announced. Bernie, did you read that in the paper yesterday, the Wall Street Journal, about DuPont's announcement?
They're
farming out their law work to India.
Okay.
I mean, they're lawyers.
Right. It's lawyers. We certainly know that there are accountants. We know that there are radiologists. When you get your taxes, or when you go to somebody to help you fill out your tax forms, Increasingly, those are also being done in India. Mm-hmm. Airplane reservations are being done in India. When you're getting your computer, getting advice on how to fix your computer, that's being done in India. Huge issue. And the issue here flies right in the face of all of those people, Democrats as well as Republicans, who have been telling us for years, is, listen, don't worry about outsourcing. Yeah, we'll lose blue-collar manufacturing jobs, but we, you know, you learn how to work computers, you get a good education, you'll have a secure, well-paid job in America. That turns out not to be the truth either. John raises a huge issue. Again, tied up with the issue I mentioned a moment ago, globalization, how we make it work for the American people. So to answer John, yes, there are some of us who are deeply concerned about that issue, and we're looking at ways to get a handle on it. Clearly, the outsourcing of legal jobs or accounting jobs is very different than the loss of manufacturing blue-collar jobs, and it needs another approach. One of the handles may well be that many of these countries do not have privacy standards to the degree that we do. We may be able to pass legislation that says that countries that do not have the kinds of standards cannot guarantee privacy to the degree consistent with American law. I should not be able to do that. But John's point is very well taken, and how we get a handle on the outsourcing of information technology, white-collar jobs, computer-related jobs, huge, huge issue.
And you expect something may be done about that?
Absolutely.
You're going to be pushing for it.
It's going to be tough, but some of us, it's on my agenda, very, very high up on my agenda, absolutely. Yeah.
Brad in Mill Valley, California, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Yes, I'm calling because I'm concerned about the private corporations in this country can count over 90% of the votes. Election systems and software in Sequoia have been convicted of bribery and suborning public officials in more than a dozen states. Walden O'Dell, the CEO of Diebold, said he was committed to deliver Ohio's electoral votes to President Bush last time. And hacking, and in the documentary Hacking Democracy about black box voting, Bev Harris shows how University of California at Berkeley, as well as Princeton University computer scientists, have showed that there was an executable component, not just a storage component, in the memory chip of Diebold machines that allowed people to manipulate the votes, and that's why Al Gore in the year 2000 received a negative 16,000 votes in Volusia County in Florida.
So, Brad, to your point.
One point is.
Your question, really, for Bernie.
Brad, I think we do have the point, and I don't, you know. And Tom Hartman has written about this and probably knows almost as much about it as anybody in the country. I think Brad. I would respond to Brad in two ways. Number one, it is a serious issue. And I think that so long as any possibility exists that touchscreen voting can be manipulated, I think we should not go in that direction. I'd rather go back to paper ballots and paper trails and so forth and so on. So I think we have to be very conservative to make sure that Americans feel absolutely confident that all the votes cast are in fact counted. On the other hand, let us not get paranoid. I know that before this election, you know, there were some people absolutely convinced that Republicans could lose because Diebold was going to deliver the votes to them. Not quite true. And in fact, some of the closest senatorial elections in Montana, in Virginia, decided by a few thousand votes, the Republicans lost the election. So let's not get paranoid. On the other hand, let's be very, very vigilant to make sure that every vote cast in America is accurately counted.
Jake in Eureka, California, KGOE. Hey, Jake.
Hey, how's it going, Tom? Senator Sanders, I'd just like to ask you about what the new majority in the Senate is going to do about the blatant cronyism and corruption of Dick Cheney. We know in the House that Henry Waxman will have investigations about Halliburton and all their dirty dealings down in New Orleans and in Iraq with the billions missing. And with, you know, Dick Cheney being the person in charge of all this, and he's, of course, the former CEO of Halliburton, I'd like to know what the Senate plans to do about this, and can we look forward to a Dick Cheney resignation in 2007?
Well, you have to ask Dick Cheney about that, but what you know, I think you will see also in the Senate are investigations and questions asked about contracting in Iraq. Clearly there have been many, many no-bid contracts, which have cost the American people dearly, while Halliburton has become very wealthy. It's not just Halliburton, it's other companies, even in terms of Hurricane Katrina. So clearly there need to be very serious investigations about Halliburton and other corporations that are benefiting from no-bid contracts. Also, I would like to revisit the role that Cheney played in the energy bill, which ended up providing a lot of corporate welfare to many of his cronies in big energy oil companies and so forth.
Barbara in Charlottesville, Virginia. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. In addition to the compassion that you feel for Senator Johnson, I am scared out of my skull at the implications of this, and I wonder if you would explicitly state the conditions under which someone can be removed, a senator can be removed from office. I am thinking of the years that Thurmond was non compos mentis, and he was in the Senate. And there's so many rumors, and you know, you hear these pious Republicans who are praying, and I know that secretly they're praying for something else. And I'm not paranoid. I mean,
well, let me just,
I'm scared.
You know, they have, believe me, there are a lot of lawyers and historians and archivists looking at this stuff, but I'll tell you what, nothing more than I read in the newspapers. First of all, I mean, let me just say this. I know Tim Johnson. I knew him in the House where I served with him, and recently I've, over the last year, he's been very helpful to me in my campaign, giving me advice, and just talked to him a few days before his illness. And the good news right now is, from what one is reading in the paper, is that his recovery is progressing. Now, we don't know what will happen tomorrow, but apparently the operation was a success, and he is doing as well as can be expected given the seriousness of his problem. Second of all, what I understand, and certainly precedent backs up, there have been a number of senators who have been incapacitated, who have missed many, many votes for long periods of time, including years, who have remained in the United States Senate. And I think everything being equal, that appears to be the case right now.
So even if it takes him like a year to recover from a stroke, as is often the case, he could still hold his Senate seat and hold that.
To the very best of my knowledge, I think the only...
That has happened in the past.
That has happened in the past. I think death and resignation are the ways you lose your seat. And if you're alive and you're recovering, I think precedent has it that you retain your seat.
Okay. Tom in Los Angeles, California, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hey, Bernie. Good talking to you. What are we going to do about the Patriot Act? What are you going to do about the Patriot Act to try to get that off the books? And what are you going to do to make sure that bills have to be read in the future before you can vote on them? I think that's borderline criminal, totally negligent on the part of our lawmakers.
Yeah. I think there is little debate that the last Congress run by right-wing Republicans in the House and the Senate was the most incompetent and poorly run, not to mention corrupt, in modern American history. And one of the aspects of it is that we continuously received very long pieces of legislation just a short time before one had to vote, which is not the way you do or should do business. I expect that will be significantly changed under Democratic leadership. In terms of the Patriot Act, there are a whole number of pieces of legislation that have attacked constitutional rights and civil liberties that I hope will be reviewed, and I will be active in that process.
And I should note for our new listeners, you are the guy who led the charge against the Patriot Act's library provisions.
Yes.
In the House of Representatives.
That is correct.
45, and took a lot of flack for it. 45 minutes past the hour. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Back with your calls right after this in the Tom Hartman program.
Oh, you better watch out. I'm telling you why. The FAA doubts that Santa will fly. Santa Claus is coming by ground. His bags were too weird. They're posting his bun. They're checking his beard. He's getting the one. Santa isn't leaving the ground. He'd take a flight if he could. They thought his suit was weird. They profiled him as bad. was last time he flew. He tried to board his sleigh with shampoo. TSA does not like his ilk. He might spring on some cookies and milk.
And welcome back. 51 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The pill that will help you escape the matrix. Our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Patrick in Brattleboro, Vermont. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, how you doing?
Good.
Good. I was wondering what you thought of Dennis Kucinich's announcement recently to withdraw funding for the war, and because we have a president who refuses to recognize the facts or the will of the people. And he also mentions $70 billion that's already on the table that could fund the withdrawal.
I think we've got to bring our troops home as soon as possible. I think taking a hard look at the budget and seeing how looking at the budget can help us bring the troops home is certainly absolutely appropriate.
Ken in Los Angeles, California. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yes, my question is this. One of the most insidious and successful efforts of the Bush administration has been to plant ideologues in various departments, be it education or environment, EPA, banking, whatever. And my question is, and their job has been either to ignore or subvert the law, or turn the laws on their head. Now, as a practical matter, what can the new Congress do to get these ideological bureaucrats in departments like the EPA and health and commerce to enforce the laws in the way they're meant to be enforced?
Well, Ken, you've asked a very important question, and you're absolutely right. What we see is over the years Bush has appointed to many environmental agencies people who have worked for polluters, people who are adamantly anti-environment, et cetera, et cetera. I think, you know, the answer is probably twofold. Number one, we can do our best to make sure that ideologues do not get appointed to head major agencies, do not get approval from the Senate whenever that can occur. And the second thing you can do is write legislation, in a sense, take as much responsibility as you can away from reactionary administrators. And this is tough stuff. It's hard to make things happen if you don't have an administration to want to make it happen. But build legislation with a full understanding that you're going to run into a great deal of opposition and write it in a way that things happen whether or not the top administrators want it to happen.
Larry, good strategy. Larry in Grand Rapids, Michigan, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Bernie. I got a question. As we hear stories about them wanting to increase the military and possibly send even more of our reserves over to Iraq, I guess I'm concerned from stories I heard about the behavior of contractors like Blackwater when they went into New Orleans after Katrina. I'm not sure who do these people answer to, and how do you feel about what basically is a private mercenary army being deployed on our soil?
Well, it's not only – that's a good point. Certainly under Rumsfeld, there has been a significant increase in the privatization of our military. That's absolutely correct, and I have real problems with that. I think it is not cost-effective. I think it's wrong. I think it lowers the morale of the men and women in the armed forces when they find that somebody next to them is making five times as much money as they are making, among other things. But it is not only the privatization of parts of our military, it is the privatization of many, many elements of our government. The Bush administration has been very clear that if they had their way, and they've been resisted not only by our unions but by many of us in Congress, if they had their way, they would privatize probably, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of jobs to private contractors. I think that is very bad public policy.
Thank you, Mark. In Arlington, Virginia, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, Bernie, I got a question. Now that the Democrats are in charge, don't they introduce legislation and that kind of thing and into Congress?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, why don't they just stop dealing with these lobbyists from the major corporations? Why don't they just quit talking to them? These guys would buy up and go away because, if they can't get their stuff put in front of the committees, they quit dealing with you. You quit dealing with them.
Well, one of the things that will happen, I think one of the very first pieces of legislation that's going to surface will be legislation dealing with ethics and really also dealing with lobbyists. Among other things, I believe there will be very strong language that members of Congress literally can take no gifts at all from lobbyists. I mean, that's including lunch, doing away with what's an area that has really been abused is hitching rides on corporate planes and paying very small sums of money for that, dealing with what we call the revolving door situation, where one day you have a colleague sitting next to you, and next year or a short period of time that person is a lobbyist, and how that person relates to Congress will also be dealt with. So I think you're going to see some fairly strong language, and some of us will fight to make it as strong as possible dealing with a lobbyist situation.
Within the constraints of the constitutionality of
right,
free speech.
Right.
Yeah,
of course.
That's always the hurdle with lobbyists, is
yes,
their right to free speech.
Every citizen of this country is technically a lobbyist if they call up the member of Congress.
Right, yeah, and should have the right to do so.
Of course.
Bernie Sanders, Bernie.org, the website, and you're keeping that, right?
Well, we're in the middle of transiting to a Senate website, which will be up, but I think that's still up, yeah.
All right, great. Thanks so much for being with us today, Bernie.
Good to talk to you, Tom.
Always
Thank
great
you.
Talking Bye-bye. With you. In the third hour of our program, we're going to be working on my new book, Cracking the Code. And next hour, more news. We'll be taking your calls. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Congress has left, or right, the headline. L.A. Times, Washington Post, News Service, Congress exits stage Reich. Well, right. Tax breaks in its wake. And this is so emblematic of everything that is wrong with conservative control of the House of Representatives and the Senate, and the White House, for that matter. And I say conservative because this is not limited to the Republican Party, although they are totally sold out. But there are certainly a number of Democrats in that category as well. This is, let me just share some of the highlights of this with you. Because it so perfectly illustrates and highlights the issues, the real issues that Americans are facing right now. And will be facing, are increasingly facing on a day-to-day basis. The rancorous 109th Congress adjourned Saturday morning with final passage of measures to expand civilian nuclear trade with India, establish permanent trade relations with Vietnam, and extend a bevy of expiring business tax breaks. That's a whole bunch in one sentence, and it doesn't sound like a whole lot. Let's drill down into that a little bit. First of all, you know, the obligatory Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, the Republican from Tennessee, ended his Senate career and called the Congress adjourned at 4:35 a.m., he's speaking to an empty room as, you know, for the camera. He says, I will truly miss each and every one of you. The centerpiece of the closing hour's work was article by Jonathan Weissman and Stephen Barr. The centerpiece of the closing hour's work was a tax and trade bill. The measure temporarily extended expiring tax breaks for businesses. It extended, I'm skipping around here, it extended a generous deduction for state and local sales taxes that was slipped into a business tax law in 2004 as a temporary measure to win votes in states without income taxes, but is taking on an air of permanence. The huge package also contained measures to permanently normalize trade with Vietnam and extend trade benefits for four Andean countries, sub-Saharan African countries, and Haiti. The Haiti provision was strongly challenged by some southern lawmakers who said it would further erode jobs in their state's textile industries. Well, I would say all of these measures with each one of these countries where we start drinking this Tom Friedman Kool-Aid, where we start going down this road of, oh yeah, let's just level the playing field. Let's have the same rules for everybody. Except we're only going to have the same rules for multinational corporations in terms of trade. We're not going to have the same rules on the environment. They can, in other countries, they can pollute the environment all they want if they can manufacture something more cheaply there than manufacturing it here, where they have to do it in a fairly clean way. They can pay their labor as little as they want in that country if they have a low standard of living or a low cost of living compared with what it costs to live here in the United States. Hey, this is nuts, these trade, just plain old flat out nuts. And then it gets even weirder. Back to the story by Weissman and Barr, the LA Times Washington Post service. The U.S.-India nuclear cooperation deal set aside years of U.S. non-proliferation treaty. And this is the nuclear non-proliferation treaty policy that forbids the trade of nuclear reactor technologies to nations that refuse to sign the International Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, such as India. So India refuses to sign the treaty. They say, no, we're not going to say that we're not going to build a bomb. By the way, would you please sell us a reactor? The reactors we have, we'd like to use to build bombs. So you can sell us reactors that can't be used to build bombs, but we're going to keep the ones that we have that can be used to build bombs. Is that okay with you? And George Bush says, oh, yeah, it's fine. Yep, yep, yep. Oh, no problem at all. Why? Well, according to the paper, Bush hailed the action as a means of enabling India and the United States to work together to promote energy production without polluting the atmosphere or contributing to global warming. Right. If you believe that, I have a bridge to sell you in Brooklyn, or to Brooklyn. What this is really all about is, I don't recall if it was GE or Westinghouse. It was one of these big companies. And Westinghouse, by the way, this is the next story I wanted to share with you about Japan returns to the global stage as an acquirer. Let's see here. Westinghouse Electric, $5.4 billion, purchased by the Japanese February 6th, 2006. Anyhow, Bush, what it's really all about is paying off big corporate buddies of the Bush administration and the Republican Party. And it's not good for the world. It's not good to increase the number of nuclear power plants in the world. It's not good to enable India, to make it much easier for India to produce more nuclear bombs. And it's not going to stop global warming or stop pollution of the atmosphere, because nuclear power is pretty much as polluting as every other kind of power. Yes, I realize nuclear power doesn't produce carbon dioxide, but the mining of uranium does. Fossil fuel is used for the mining. The refining of uranium does. Fossil fuels are used by and large for the refining of it. And then you get the transportation of it. You get the storage of it. Plus, the world is running out of uranium. I mean, have you looked at the price of uranium lately? I mean, it's gone from $12 or whatever it is, a kilo, more or less, as I recall, like 8-10 years ago. It's around $70, $80 now. I mean, people are making a killing investing in uranium futures and uranium stocks, but it's, yeah. Anyway, so that's nuts. A handful of other Republican budget hawks, along with some Democrats, presumably, held up passage of the tax and trade bill because the measure's 10-year, $50 billion cost would void deficit control measures. He actually had a few Republicans, like Judd Gregg from New Hampshire, the guy who won because the Republicans jammed the phone lines. Remember that? When the very, very popular, well, maybe that was Sununu from New Hampshire. It was one of the two New Hampshire senators. Actually, now that I think about it, I think it was John Sununu who was running against the Democratic governor, and they jammed the phone lines. But in any case, the other senator from New Hampshire, he says, we shouldn't pass this thing because we're going to go $50 billion in debt. Yeah, because we're not going to make money from tariffs, and we're going to give more tax breaks to corporations. Oh, but, it's going to help our corporate buddies. So they passed it. So that's what Congress did on its last day. They adjourned at 4:35 in the morning. In the meantime, Japan is back as a global buyer. This on the front page of today's Wall Street Journal article by Andrew Morse and Jason Singer. Japan is back as a global buyer. The country's biggest tobacco company is close to agreeing on the nation's largest ever foreign acquisition with an offer valued at $14.8 billion. They're back to what they were doing in the early 1990s. The proposed deal marks one of the highest profile foreign forays by corporate Japan since it stirred worries in the United States in the 1980s and early 90s. You will recall that was when Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, and these giant mergers and acquisitions became possible, which brought a lot of these foreign countries in, foreign companies from foreign countries into the United States, buying up, you know, huge swaths of America and aggregating them into giant companies with multiple company names. Before 1982, it was by and large illegal. But Reagan was borrowing so much money from the rest of the world, and he was taking us down the road of these insane trade policies where we were buying so much from the rest of the world and not selling to the rest of the world, that the rest of the world ended up with all these dollars. What are they going to do? They have to spend them someplace. Well, as they note in the Wall Street Journal, in the early 90s, with a wave of investments that resulted in the Japanese takeover of such American icons as the Pebble Beach Golf Course in California. Yes, it's Japanese-owned. New York's Rockefeller Center. Yes, it's Japanese-owned. And Hollywood's Columbia Pictures. Yes, it's Japanese-owned. Japanese companies are once again on the prowl. Then there's this little chart, a little graph here on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Renewed appetite. Biggest purchases of stakes in all or part of overseas companies by Japanese buyers. AT&T Wireless, $9.1 billion. RJ Reynolds International, $7.83 billion. MCA, $7.09 billion. Vario, $6.32 billion. Westinghouse Electric, $5.4 billion. Columbia Pictures Entertainment, $4.65 billion. Pilkington, $4 billion. They note, so far this year, Japanese firms have bought up 294 foreign companies for a total of $18.1 billion, more than in all of 2005 and double the figure in 2004. Now, again, I'm not saying, oh, my God, the Japanese are coming. It's nothing like that. I'm not picking on Japan. What I'm saying is that through our insane taxation policies of Reaganomics, trickle-down economics, and our insane trade policies pursued by Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and Bush, we should call it Friedmanomics, we have created a situation where this kind of thing is happening, and we need to do something about it. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. And welcome back to the radio support group up by and for We the People of the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. Another article in today's Wall Street Journal. It's amazing. I don't even need to visit the liberal websites. I have to do show prep. It's all right there in the conservative, and they're proud of it. Trade ruling on steel may boost auto industry. Letting some tariffs lapse is a big win for car makers. A tilt toward consumers. Yes, but we're not going to make steel in America anymore. From January to October 2006, U.S. steel imports. Now, keep in mind, we have tariffs on steel right now. As we say, okay, if you're going to make steel in your country and your labor and your manufacturing costs to make it are cheaper than ours, or you're subsidizing it in some way, then you're going to have to pay a tax when you sell that into the United States that levels the playing field. So that basically the cost of steel coming from any other country in the world is the same as the cost of steel made in the United States. And even at that, in the period from January to October 2006, that is basically this year, 16.5%, 16.6% of the steel in the United States came from Canada, 11.5% of the steel in the United States came from China, 7.5% of the steel in the United States came from Mexico, 6.5% from Korea, 5.7% from Japan, 5.5% from Russia, 4.4% from Germany, 4.1% from Brazil, 3.9% from Taiwan, 3.2% from India. You add it all up, it's a little over half, I believe. I haven't actually sat down with a calculator, but... Now, here's the ironic sentence. I mean, they open this thing. This article opens up here in the Wall Street Journal. Decisions that signal the end of many U.S. steel tariffs promise struggling automakers a boost and reflect a shift in the political and economic fortunes of these two pillars of the U.S. economy. And they go on to say domestic steelmakers, which have long received favored treatment in Washington, were surprised by the ruling. Yes, I imagine. It's very disappointing, said Don D'Amico, chairman and CEO of Charlotte, North Carolina-based Nucor Corp., one of the U.S.'s three largest steel producers that has lobbied to keep the trade restrictions. The decision by the ITC, an independent agency with broad authority over U.S. trade policy. And they go through all this. And now, here's where it gets, I mean, this is just bang. Get this. Get the irony of this. All of the duties were implemented more than a decade ago. But this is during the Clinton administration. At the time, the steel industry was reeling from the dumping of low-price subsidized imports into the market. Okay, so we had 10 years ago, we had a steel industry that was being wiped out, just like pretty much every other industry in the United States has been wiped out, because we did not have trade policy, because we were doing the Clinton trade thing, right? NAFTA, CAFTA, GATT, WTO. We were doing the George Herbert Walker Bush trade thing, the George W. Bush trade thing, the Reagan trade thing, most favored nation status for some of these countries, which eliminates tariffs. And so our steel industry was in the tank. The article continues. Today, the steel industry is strong and profitable. And the auto companies argue that the duties are no longer needed and that the elimination of the duties would inject more competition into the steel industry. Period. End of sentence. End of paragraph. And you know who was lobbying for this? The case brought together rival U.S. and Japanese automakers, General Motors, okay, there's an American company, Ford, an American company, Daimler Chrysler, a German company, Toyota Motor, a Japanese company, Honda Motor, a Japanese company, Nissan Motor, a Japanese company, in the first ever alliance in a trade dispute. All of their stocks went up, by the way, the steel company's stocks went down. So here we have these multinational companies, German, Japanese, by and large, saying, you know, we don't need a steel industry in the United States. We'll make your steel in Germany and Japan. After all, we imported $1.5 billion worth of steel from Japan last year. We imported $1.2 billion from Germany. I mean, why not? Amazing. I mean, this is why the whole idea of saying, oh, yeah, 200 years of tariffs in the United States. This started in 1787, Tench Cox passing the first tariff bill to protect American industries and keep business here in this country and build an industrial infrastructure. And it wasn't until 1980 that they started disassembling that. And by coincidence, in 1980 was when the middle class started to die in the United States. Reaganism, Reaganomics, free trade, global free trade. It's only free for the big multinational corporations. Hey, time now for the Tom Hartman Program's Progressive Pop Quiz. Our question for the day today, as one of its final acts, Congress passed legislation allowing U.S. multinationals to sell what to India? The sixth caller with the correct answer at 1-866-440-THOM, 866-440-8466, gets an autographed copy of my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. Answer coming up after the break, 27 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Program, where reason is our lifestyle choice. Welcome back. Tell the truth that the multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about. Tom Hartman here with you. We have a winner in our Progressive Pop Quiz. Our question was, as one of its final acts, Congress passed legislation allowing U.S. multinationals to sell what to India? And congratulations to Lynn Hunsinger in Eureka, California, listening on KGOE. Lynn knew that the correct answer was nuclear technology or nuclear power plants. Lynn actually said nuclear power plants, which is exactly correct. Thank you very much, Lynn, for participating. Much appreciated. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. TomHartmann.com if you want to drop into our live chat room and hang out with some of the finest minds on the entire Internet. Actually, I learn things in our chat room. I hang out there during the breaks, and it's a great place. I want to just summarize this, just pull this all together here. There is, and you know, bring it down to the ground and what we can do about it. From the very earliest days of this country, I mean, literally the very earliest days of this country, on page 181, in fact, of my book, Screwed, you will find, on page 179, excuse me, March 11, 1792, a letter from Jefferson, actually it was in a diary entry, about Alexander Hamilton and how they were debating how much of a tariff they should place on France. And then George Washington weighs in, and Jefferson writes, "The president thought it was worth trying, and I acquiesced. I prepared a plan of treaty for exchanging the privileges of native subjects and fixing all duties forever as they now stood. Hamilton did not like this way of fixing the duties because he said many articles here would bear to be raised, and therefore he would prepare a tariff. He did so, raising duties for the French from 25% to 50%. So they were to give us the privilege of native subjects, and we as a compensation were to pay them, make them pay higher duties." You get it? Using a form of taxation called tariffs or duties as an instrument of foreign policy in a way, as a way of generating revenue, 100% of the income of the federal government in the United States came from tariffs from the founding of this country until the Civil War. And as a way of protecting domestic industries. It's how we keep our jobs here. And then you get the flip side of this. You get these crazies like, you know, Tom Friedman, David Sirota writing about this, a brilliant piece over at workingforchange.com titled "Billionaire Tom and the Danger of Education Mythmaking." He says, Friedman's trying to pull a fast one on us. He writes, and he's quoting from Tom Friedman, one of Tom Friedman's new columns, you know, in the New York Times. Friedman says, "Why should any employer anywhere in the world pay Americans to do highly skilled work if other people just as well educated are available in less developed countries for half our wages?" Well, that's a reasonable question. The answer is they shouldn't. But that answer would reveal how bankrupt, how insane the policy of saying, oh, yeah, let's just do away with tariffs. Let's just go with global free trade. Let the corporations decide what's best for the world. To hell with individual nation states. It doesn't matter that different countries have different standards of living, different natural resource bases, different levels of development. It just doesn't matter in their minds. What matters is whether the multinational corporation is able to vacuum up, is able to strip mine labor or resources out of any country in the world they want, including the United States. It's kind of ironic, really, because for a long time we were accused of doing this to much of the rest of the world, and in fact we were. Now much of the rest of the world is doing it to us. Well, actually, it's not even much of the rest of the world, because there's not, arguably, China. But beyond that, there's not so much a country out there whose policy is to strip mine the United States. It's multinational corporations doing it. 52 of the 100 largest economies in the world are not countries. They're corporations. So anyhow, Friedman asked this rhetorical question. Why would any employer in the world want to pay Americans if they can get the same work in a less developed country at half our wages? And then he answers his own rhetorical question with this insane answer. He says, and I quote, "There is only one right answer to that question. In a globally integrated economy, our workers will get paid a premium only if they or their firms offer a uniquely innovative product or service which demands a skilled and creative labor force to conceive, design, market, and manufacture, and a labor force that is constantly able to keep learning." What, like every other country in the world is not going to have labor forces that can come up with ideas? Like we've got to figure out a way to... What are we going to do? Put in the water supply of the rest of the world large quantities of Valium so everybody's just sitting around stoned all the time? I mean, this is crazy. In a globally integrated economy, David Sirota notes, Tom Friedman doesn't want us wondering why the global economy has been integrated with complex intellectual patent and copyright protections, but no similar protections for wages, human rights, or environmental concerns. He says this just exposes how totally out of reach he really is. And then he makes a point that I think is probably frankly true of the Rahm Emanuels and the DLC Democrats and the Tom Friedmans of the world, and certainly all the Republicans who are mouthing this stuff as if they really believe that it's best for America. He says, it makes all these people feel better about themselves if they can come up with a storyline that says, one, all their success is because they worked hard, got educated, and pulled themselves up by their bootstraps, which, by the way, completely ignores the whole public infrastructure, education, everything else. And two, none of their success had anything to do with an economic structure that rewards a very few people who come from privilege with a huge amount and a very many people who are average with almost nothing. He says many of America's most successful icons did work hard, get educated, and pull themselves up by their bootstraps, but most also found ways to exploit advantages in the system. Beware of the great education myth. 1-866-440-8466, our number. And Jim in Seattle, Washington, on the line. Hey, Jim, welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm fine, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, I had an interesting event happen last night. I don't know if you guys got it down there in Portland, but up here in Seattle, we got a vicious windstorm.
Oh, yeah, it was incredible. We live in a houseboat in the Willamette River, and I was laying in the bathtub trying to make my back stop hurting as 40, 50-mile-an-hour winds were hitting our house, and it was rocking around, and the water was – it was actually kind of cool, but it was pretty – yeah, there's a couple hundred thousand people who I think still don't have power here in Portland.
Yeah, well, I live on a sailboat down here at the marina. And 1 o'clock in the morning, one of our neighbor boats, their roller furling started to unfurl, and it was flogging in the wind. So I got up and dressed, put my foul weather gear on, went out and took care of the boat. There was about four of us out there, and we're wrestling with this thing in 60-mile-an-hour winds. And, it just kind of made me realize that, these free market people, the libertarians, Tom Friedmans, those kind of people, do they want to live in a market or do they want to live in a community? Because the market wouldn't get up at 1 o'clock in the morning in their pajamas and go and help somebody out.
Yep, exactly right. Exactly right. Well said, Jim. Well said. Thank you very much for sharing that story. I mean, that is really well done. Andy in Seattle, and thanks for helping out your neighbor. Hey, Andy, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. I just wanted to maybe even build upon what your last caller just said. Why do we want to have trade is it to enrich multinational corporations, or is it to help all the people of the world?
Right. Well, that was the point that Adam.
Markets.
Yeah, this is the point that Adam Smith made in Wealth of Nations, was that if you have that, the reason why you don't want to have trade is if you want to protect industries within your own country, or you want to, for strategic or for practical and economic reasons. On the other hand, the reason why you do want to have trade is if one country makes really great wine because of their unique geography, another country makes really great cheese, and a third country makes very good sweaters because they have a lot of sheep. Then all, wouldn't it be nice if everybody in all three countries could sit around wearing a nice warm sweater, drinking wine and eating cheese? That's the reason to have trade. But when all three of those countries start making wine, cheese, and sweaters, then at that point you start saying, okay, we want to protect our domestic industries.
Exactly.
Yeah.
One more comment?
Yeah.
George Bush pledged to run the country like a corporation, if I remember.
Yes, he did, and he's doing
what,
so.
What corporation would continue to run an $800 billion deficit
and
not change their policies?
Enron.
Yeah.
George Bush is running the United States just like a corporation. He's running it just like the corporation that was the largest funder of his political career, Enron.
He's running it for corporations.
Yeah,
not like
there's that, too. There's that, too.
Yeah.
Andy, thanks for the call. John in Greenberg, Pennsylvania. Hey, John.
Thank you for taking my call. Mr. Friedman's question: well, why would a multinational corporation want to pay American workers, more than their foreign-born counterparts? I'm thinking, well, why not simply? I mean, there's a host of other questions to ask. Why would a corporation want to pay the cost necessary to make sure they comply with environmental standards?
Exactly.
Why should a corporation want to have to expend the money to make sure they have a safe workplace?
Yep.
Why should a corporation operate in a country that prohibits them from using slave labor?
Yep.
I mean, this notion that corporations have absolutely you know, let's, corporation doesn't exist as an entity. The idea that the people who operate a corporation and the stockholders of the corporation have no obligation to the sovereign nation in which they live. In which
that's how it used to be. It used to be in the United States up until the 1890s.
Yes.
Every state in the union had laws that said if you incorporate, your first statement of incorporation must be that your primary purpose is to support
the interest of the state in which you're incorporated.
That's exactly right. And that no longer exists in corporate charters. And so now we have essentially sociopaths, entities created at law, artificial entities created at law that are sociopathic. 45 minutes past the hour.
It's always Christmas time for pizza. MasterCard gets presents every day. They're happy as can be when we discover neath our tree the finance charge that never goes away. It's always Christmas time for Visa. The lenders feel the splendor and the cheer. The interest that they're making is the gift that keeps on taking and leaves us buried deeper every year.
And welcome back. Fair and slightly unbalanced. The Tom Hartman radio program. Yes, this from the wire service. Concerned that the GOP might resort to desperate measures to recapture the Senate, Democrats today posted more than a dozen armed guards at the hospital bedside of recuperating Senator Tim Johnson. Incoming Majority Leader Harry Reid explained that their concerns were raised when an overweight nurse who looked suspiciously like Dick Cheney walked into Johnson's room and announced, "Time for your sponge bath, Senator!" Similarly, the Democrats are also wargaming their worst-case scenario and thus plan to consult with the special effects coordinator from Weekend at Bernie's. I'm sorry. That's not really from the word. It's satiricalpolitical.com. By Don Davis. He comes up with some... yes, this is a tragedy and a terrible thing, but I think occasionally we need to lighten up, eh? 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Scott in Middlebury, Vermont. Hey, Scott, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
There you go. I just wanted to find out... I kind of miss Bernie Sanders. I had a question for him, but I guess I can find out where you stand on this. What I wanted to see was the immigrants, the illegal Mexicans coming in to Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
There's pretty much no dairy farm in Vermont anymore that doesn't have illegals,
mm-hmm.
if they can afford them. And then my wife worked for a farm 2.5 years, and she was just laid off a couple weeks before Christmas because this guy, he's got himself a couple of illegals.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's just getting out to the point, and well, what do you think is going to happen with how we're going to stop them, or if they are going to stop them?
Yeah. Well, I can't speak for Bernie, although I believe in the past on my program on a number of occasions, I've heard him say essentially take the same position that I take, which is that we don't have a problem in the United States with illegal immigrants. We have a problem with illegal employers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have a job magnet in the United States, and that's people who are willing to hire people regardless of their immigration status. And when we start putting some of those employers in jail, then a lot of this problem is going to go away. You know, we had back in the 50s, we had about 1 million people coming north across the border every year and going south across the border about 1 million people every year as well at the end of agricultural season. Now we have about 1 million people a year coming across the border and staying here because they get jobs beyond just, you know, seasonal agricultural jobs.
Right.
And you've got Democrats on the one hand saying, oh, yeah, well, let's just have a guest worker program. Well, you've got George Bush, for that matter, saying that. And to me, that's just, you know, yeah, let's have an exploitable labor force to further drive down the cost of labor.
Right.
And then you've got Republicans, on the other hand, who are whipping up hysteria and racial hatred, basically. I mean, you know, just race baiting, going, oh, my God, it's brown people coming. I mean, you know, we need to put up a wall. We need to, you know, get guns. We need to have the Minutemen down here, which is equally crazy. And then you got people saying, well, what do you want to do? Get 1 million buses and deport them all? It's going to cost you $42 billion. And I say, no, you don't have to deport anybody. You quit hiring them, and most of them will leave.
Right. Well, there was
and by the way, let me add, if they left, they would go back to Mexico, where they would be the social activists who would not have allowed a conservative to have been elected as president of Mexico a few months ago.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing, well, how about that mayor? I don't know if in Hazleton, Pennsylvania. And that's where me and my wife are originally from.
Yeah, who there's several communities that are making it illegal to hire illegals. And
they have a right to work, but work in your own country.
Exactly. You know, exactly. In my mind, this is frankly, my position is the progressive position. I've written about this several times on commondreams.org, and you can find the articles if you go to tomhartman.com and click articles on democracy, and they're down in the archives. And what's amazing to me is the number of people who are, quote, liberal or progressive, who are arguing for things like guest worker programs and how politically correct that's become. And yet, when I write pieces for commondreams.org, pointing out that the progressive movement since the mid-1800s has been working to have, you know, immigration policies so that the ratio of labor to demand for labor, availability of labor to demand for labor in the United States is relatively skewed on the side of demand for labor. In other words, there's more demand for labor than there is labor, thus driving up the cost of labor and creating a middle class. That's why unions start. I mean, that's the origin of the Wobblies. That's the origin of the 50-hour work week and then the 40-hour work week, is to restrict the availability of labor. It's the origin of the child labor laws. It's, you know, just go right on down the list. It has always been the progressive position. Cesar Chavez marched with Walter Mondale down to the Mexican border to protest illegal immigrants coming in, busting up his union, the farm workers union. So I believe that I'm taking the progressive position, and what's amazing to me is how many people will out loud say that I'm not, that I'm somehow, you know, that this is some kind of conservative position. And yet when I write about this on Common Dreams, I get a flood of email from progressives and liberals saying, right on, you're telling the truth.
Yeah. Right. That's exactly the truth.
And it's like politicians. Yes. There are very few politicians in America who are willing to even talk about this, who are willing to touch this, who, you know, it's radioactive. And it needn't be. It should be about what's best for the American workforce. And I'm all in favor of immigration, by the way, legal immigration. My
right.
sister-in-law is in the process of becoming an American citizen right now.
Right.
I mean, she's like 3 years into a 5-year process.
Yes,
but, you know, God bless her. And I think that we should open up, you know, to more immigrants, frankly, particularly, I mean, you got people in Darfur who are dying. You got people around the world who, and there's some very good reasons for them to be coming into the United States. Like I said, don't get me started, Scott.
Yep.
We'll do a whole hour on this next week. We're going to come back after. Thanks for the call. After the break, we're going to come back and talk about how to communicate political messages. I'm writing a book on the air here with you, and we're actually going to do some on-air examples of this. It's going to be a lot of fun. Cracking the code. How to communicate political messages. And, you know, just this whole process. How do you most effectively transmit politics? 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to Tom Hartman Radio Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. For the first time that I know of, I mean, I might be wrong on this, but I don't think so. An author putting part of the writing process of a new book on the air. That's me. I have 19 books in print right now on 5 continents and 16 languages, I think. And I'm finishing up a new book, which will not be out until the fall of 2007. It'll be in bookstores in the fall of 2007. But I have to have it finished into the publisher by February. And so we're doing this actually on the air, doing this book on the air, and in part, and finishing it up on the air. The title of the book is Cracking the Code, The Art and Science of Political Persuasion. You can't find it anywhere yet. It's not online. It's not on Amazon, anything like that. It's going to be next year's book. But every week we're going to be, in the last hour of our Friday segments, we're going to be working out a chapter or a lesson I'll be sharing with you about this book. And this week it's how we make decisions and how to influence people's decisions. So let's just, you know, get into this stuff and go through it. And in the right after the first break, I'm going to invite folks to call, and I'm just going to pick one call and invite a person to share with us the experience of, I'll walk you through the process of how to change an emotional state around a memory, and then, you know, tell you how in the next segment, in the third segment, at the bottom of the hour, how that all applies to politics. So here's the, this is stuff that political consultants and real high level marketers know, that they understand, and a lot of people in psychology as well, by the way. And I think it's really important that we all understand this. Number one, so we can be alert to it and for it. And number two, so that we can be more competent at communicating. And this is one of my goals in this book, Cracking the Code, is to raise all of us to the level of unconsciously competent communicators. That is, just effortlessly competent communicators. So, first of all, how do we sort emotions? Last week, what we talked about were submodalities. Just to give you a real quick recap, last week I pointed out that, or we talked about modalities, the primary modalities. The primary modalities are visual, auditory, and kinesthetic, or feeling. The primary ways that people experience the world, through their sight, through their hearing, and through their feelings or sensations. And most people have these as primary filters. People who are primarily visual will say things like, yeah, I see what you're talking about. Hey, it's great seeing you. They'll even say, as they're hanging up the phone, I'll see you later, even though they're talking to you. People who are primarily auditory will say things like, I like the sound of that, I understand what you're talking about. People who are primarily kinesthetic, and they will say, I'll talk to you later, when they hang up the phone. People who are primarily kinesthetic, who code most of their stuff and their feelings, who experience the world through their feelings, they tend to say things like, I have a good sense of that. That feels good to me. And they'll say, catch you later, when they're hanging up the phone. Right, let's stay in touch. So, number one, as we talked about last week, if you want to communicate with a person, if you know their primary filter, you want to try and step into their world. You use their language. But let's drill a level deeper than that. Each one of these modalities has a set of submodalities. That is, subsets, little pieces. For example, in visual, there's a picture can be color or black and white. It can be high contrast, low contrast. It can be, in our imagination, a memory picture. It can be near us. It can be far away from us. And there's all these different variations. Auditory submodalities, do you hear it behind you? Do you hear it in front of you? Where is it located in space? Things like that. Kinesthetic submodalities have to do with where we feel feelings, how we feel them. He felt that like a hot poker to the leg, or so, you know, something like that. He felt punched in the gut. Her heart raced. Right, these are kinesthetic subsets, right? It's kinesthetic descriptions. Now, the reason that this is useful to know is because the way that we sort information is fundamentally an irrational system. We think that we are rational beings. We think that we understand how the world works and how things are going, and that we have some sort of a rational process involved in sorting information, in understanding and storing and keeping information. But actually, it's fundamentally irrational. And the reason why is because the rational part of our brain, the left hemisphere of our brain, the part that is logical and you know, it can organize information, can do quadratic equations, that part of our brain is not the part of our brain that is primarily involved in sensing the world. It's also not the part of the brain that is primarily involved in storing or stashing information. So what happens is we have experiences throughout the day. We see things, we hear things, we feel things. We have to figure out a way to make sense and to store and to save those experiences as memories. Throughout the course of the day, we write them down on this little one-day scratch pad called the thalamus. Excuse me, called the hippocampus, by and large. This is, you know, I'm generalizing wildly here, but it's useful, I think, for purposes of this conversation. And then at night, as we dream, we process that information. And that's why our dreams seem irrational. We're trying to figure out, okay, what happened today that I need to store and what do I need to throw away? And we attach emotional tags to things. And then we store information by emotion. The filing system in our brains, in our minds, in our psyches, and really arguably even in our bodies, because it's all one thing in my mind. The filing system, you know how there are these kind of like Pentaflex makes these folders. If you're familiar with filing systems, you get these folders, colored folders, you know, blue, yellow, orange, whatnot. And then inside those, you can put the manila file folders. Well, it would be like the big folders would be like the emotions. Okay, here's the folder for happiness. Here's a folder for love. Here's a folder for pleasure of some type. And they're really subtle. I mean, there's thousands of variations of emotion for which we don't even have words. And then the larger folders. And then the smaller folders within those are made up of the individual experiences. And the way that those larger folders are defined is by this set of submodalities, where and how memories exist, how we organize our memories. So the goal here, once you understand this process, and I'm going to illustrate it to you, particularly those, I'll illustrate it for those who are visual, I'll give you an auditory example of it for those of you who are auditory, and you will get it if you're kinesthetic. When after the next break, I take a caller and I invite you, if you are interested, what I'm going to do, the process that I'm going to do, is I'm going to ask somebody who calls in to, and I'm taking a chance here, hoping that somebody is willing to do this. If not, I don't know, maybe we'll grab David. And ask that person to remember a time, and not tell us any of the details. You get to keep your secrets here. That proves how powerful this is. To remember a time in the recent past that was, you know, moderately negative in emotion. And then I'm going to show that person how to wipe the negativity out of that emotion, the negative emotion away from that, and change the emotion associated with that memory. And then we'll take a positive memory and amplify it, make it even more positive. And this is all going to be useful and productive stuff. And then after I've shown you how that's done and how that works, after I've given you the story of how that works, how we can actually have access to the filing system of our minds, how we can actually access the filing system of our minds, then in the next segment, I'm going to tell you how Newt Gingrich organized this for the Republican Party in 1994, and it is still echoing for the auditories among us. It is still visible for the visuals among us. It's still hanging around for the kinesthetics among us, even today. So we'll get into that. So, you know, if you'd like to be our guinea pig for this, and it'll actually be a lot of fun, it's you'll find it very pleasant, give us a call at 866-440-8466, and we'll pick up a caller right after the break. We'll do this example in the next segment, and then at the bottom of the hour after the example, I'll share with you, show you, tell you, give you a sense of how the Republicans have used it, and we'll talk about how we can use it in political communication, both interpersonal and institutional. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back to the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least a clean election and universal health care. How's that? It's a good starting point. 21 minutes past the hour. Lauren and Andrew, our call screener and board op in New York City at Air America Radio, were mentioning to me a few minutes ago, you know, we're still trying to figure out, am I primarily auditory, visual, or kinesthetic? Is there a test someplace? Yes, there is. The one book that I've written about this topic, this whole area of psychology, I wrote it in the context of attention deficit disorder because I've written several books on that topic. and it's called Healing ADD. If you go to TomHartmann.com and just scroll down, you'll see a whole bunch of covers of, you know, all the covers of my books that are in print and for sale right now out there. And if you click on Healing ADD, it'll take you to a website that we built for that book. And there's three chapter excerpts. And the first chapter excerpt is called How We Experience the World Differently. And if you click on that, you will find a test that you can take, 10 questions that you can answer and score yourself and figure out if you're primarily visual, auditory, or kinesthetic. So that said, we have a bunch of folks who are volunteering here, and I'm just going to arbitrarily click on one, and I've clicked on Barbara in Los Angeles. Hey, Barbara.
Hi, Tom.
We don't know each other, do we?
Yes, we do.
We do?
Yes, it's Barbara.
Barbara and Joe?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Hi.
How's that for a coincidence? Well, are you willing to do this?
Sure, I'm willing to do it. Are you willing? I mean, will your audience trust us that there's no collusion?
I suspect they will. I was really surprised that it was you, though, Barbara. It's great to hear your voice. Haven't heard from you in months.
I know, but I was listening to you on the radio. Joe and I are in the car, and I couldn't resist calling.
Well, that's great. Well, give my best to Joe and. In any case, Barbara, okay, here's
okay.
What I'd like you to do is remember something in, you know, in the recent past, the last week or so, that was a moderately unpleasant experience. The example that I would give is like somebody flipping you off in traffic or a surly waiter.
Yeah, I got one.
You got one. Okay, great.
Yeah.
Now, I want you to describe to me the submodalities associated with it. In other words, when you remember that experience, and you see the picture of that, do you see the picture in color or black and white?
Color.
Okay, is it describe in space where it is, in front of you, behind you, up, you know, where is it?
Describe in space where it is?
Yeah. If you were, because you're not, I can't see you, so you can't point to it for me, so describe to me where it is, the picture.
Picture.
Is it like 5 feet in front of you? Is it 20 feet behind you?
Oh, I see.
Is it 6 feet off to your left?
In front of me.
It's in front of you. And how far away?
I would say 5 feet.
5 feet. Okay, great.
Okay.
Is there sound associated with it?
I'm sorry, I can't.
Is there sound associated with it?
Yeah, there's sound.
Okay, and is it a movie or is it a still picture?
It's a moving picture.
Okay, great. So what I'd like you to do, Barbara, is first of all, push that picture. So we've figured out some of the submodalities associated with it, right?
Yeah.
What I'd like you to do is push that picture about twice as far away from you. Push it like 10, 15, 20 feet away from you, first of all.
Okay. I've done it.
Okay. And now turn it black and white.
Okay.
And
well,
now...
That's hard.
Oh, interesting.
To turn it into black and white.
Okay. Well, you can leave it color if you want. Maybe your brain doesn't want it black and white yet.
No, my brain doesn't want black and white.
Okay. Well, that's cool. Leave it as color. I want you to scroll all the way to the end of the movie and freeze frame it.
Scroll to the end of the movie and do what?
Freeze frame it at the very end.
Freeze frame it. Okay.
And now, in just a second, I'm going to make a whoosh sound, and I'm going to ask you to play it backwards. And you know how you play a movie backwards? Everybody moves like in the old Charlie Chaplin movies, and everybody talks backwards like Donald Duck, you know. And I want you to, right now, play it backwards all the way back to the beginning with everything going backwards, like that.
Yep, I did.
Okay, all the way to the beginning. Now, freeze frame it at the beginning. And do you see yourself in the picture, or do you see it as if you were there?
I see myself in the picture.
Okay, great. What I'd like you to do is I'd like you to paint rainbows across that picture now and put donkey ears on everybody in the picture except yourself.
Put what on everybody in the picture?
Donkey ears.
Okay. Okay.
Now, how do you feel about the experience right now?
What I did is I went back to the beginning and said, okay, this didn't happen.
Uh-huh. So you're laughing now. A few minutes ago, I'm guessing you weren't laughing about this experience.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, number one, you're laughing now. And number two, it's what you just told me is that your story about the experience has changed, has it?
My story about the experience.
The story that you tell yourself about what happened there.
Yeah.
Typically what happens... Typically what happens is stories change from, oh, gee, I was a victim to, oh, that happened, but I learned from it. That kind of a transition. Was it something like that?
No, it was, okay, that happened. Let's just accept it and deal with it. That's it.
So
instead of being so anxious about it.
Okay, so you have transformed a memory by simply shifting the filing system that your brain uses for it.
Oh, okay.
Isn't that cool? Now, yeah, here, just real quickly, push it 50 feet away, paint it on glass, in sepia tones, and with a stone in your mind, throw it and shatter it.
Okay. Thank you, Tom. Say hello to Louise.
You're welcome. I will, and give my love to Joe. Thanks, Barbara, for calling. We'll be right back, and I'll describe what happened and why this is relevant to Newt Gingrich in just a minute. 27 minutes past the hour.
Said Dick Cheney to the State of Red.
Do you fear what I fear?
Do you fear what I fear?
Ringing us words of fear and dread.
Do you fear what I fear?
Do you fear what I fear?
You know it's true. Liberals have no clue, and if more states start voting blue, terrorists will be thanking you.
It's the Dick Cheney song.
George W. when asked of Iraq.
You don't know what I know.
Welcome back. 35 minutes past the hour. You know, when I was in high school, I had a friend who was convinced that there are only 300 people in the world, and eventually you meet all of them. Everybody else is a hologram or something. I don't remember the whole theory, but that was so spooky. That were not spooky. It was so cool having Barbara call. Barbara's husband, by the way, is an actor, and she didn't say their last name on the air, so I don't know if I don't think she'd mind, but I'm not going to because she didn't. But her husband is an actor who has appeared in every Star Trek series except Star Trek The Next Generation. Unique. He's quite famous for that. He's most recently in the Alliance member Alain Christophe in the TV series Alias. He's played in a lot of series. I've seen him in the movies. And Barbara and Joe are old and dear friends who I've known for decades. And it's just remarkable. Yeah, in fact, I'm looking at his filmography here. Smoking Aces, Ice Maker, Alias, The Street Sweeper, The Scorpion King, Wishcraft, Enterprise, King Cobra. Anyhow, it goes on and on. So it was nice to hear from an old friend. But how weird. I mean, I literally, this our call screening software will hold 10 calls. There were 10 people had called. It was slammed. And I just punched down one. Art in Sacramento. Art, Lauren says you teach psychology, and you just wanted to chime in on this for a second here. Art? No? Okay. I guess Art is listening to his radio instead of his phone. Anyhow, here's what happened. We changed with Barbara. We changed the sorting system, and that changed the reality, because the reality is really what we perceive. It's not what's so. So to take this to the next step, here's how Newt Gingrich has used this. He came up with this thing. It's called contrasting words. You can Google this. You just Google, you know, Newt Gingrich word search. I forget the title of it. But he says, often we search for words. We search hard for words to help us define our opponents. Sometimes we're hesitant to use contrast. Notice the first sentence was kinesthetic. The second sentence is visual. Remember that creating a difference helps you. Remember is primarily auditory. These are powerful words that can create a clear, visual, and easily understood auditory contrast. So Newt, even in writing this, is writing to an entire audience. Apply these to the opponent, their record, proposals, and their party. So now Newt says, use these, and he actually has a video about this. He teaches this to Republican politicians and has them memorize this list. These are the words. Whenever you're going to use the word Democrat or Democratic or your opponent's name, try to figure out a way to put one of these words before that. Decay, failure, fail, collapse, deeper, crisis, urgency, destructive, destroy, sick, pathetic, lie, liberal, they, them, unionized bureaucracy, compassion is not enough, betray, consequences, limits, shallow, traitors, sensationalists, in danger, coercion, hypocrisy, radical, threaten, devour, waste, corruption, incompetent, permissive attitudes, destructive, imposed, self-serving, greed, ideological, insecure, anti-issue, anti-flag, anti-child, anti-family, anti-job, pessimistic, stagnation, welfare, corrupt, selfish, insensitive, statuesque, mandates, taxes, spending, shame, disgraceful, punish, poor, bizarre, cynicism, cheat, steal, abuse of power, machine, bosses, obsolete, criminal rights, red tape, and patronage. Oh, and excuses and intolerant. Missed this. Now, all of these words are words that I'm assuming Frank Luntz probably played a role in this, that Newt had figured out cause people to bring up pictures or bring up feelings that are negative. And if you can then attach that to your opponent, so that when you invoke the name of your political opponent, this is what Newt is suggesting, invoking the name of your political opponent causes people to bring up a picture of them, right? And then you bring up one of these words, and it brings up an emotion, or it changes some way the way that that picture is held. Now, he said, on the other hand, there are optimistic, positive, what he calls governing words. He says, use the list below to help define your campaign and your vision of public service. These words can give extra power to your message. In addition, these words help develop the positive side of the contrast you should create with your opponent. Isn't this interesting? He says, your vision of public service, there's that visual. These words can give extra power. These words, the auditory, can give extra power, kinesthetic, to your message. In addition, these words help develop the positive side of the contrast, kinesthetic, visual, you should create with your opponent, giving your community something to vote for. And here's the words that you should use whenever you're describing, this is what Newt says, you know, yourself, your positions, or in Newt's case, the Republican Party. Share, change, opportunity, legacy, challenge, control, truth, moral, courage, reform, prosperity, crusade, movement, children, family, debate, compete, actively, we, us, our, candidly, humane, pristine, provide, liberty, commitment, principled, unique, duty, precious, premise, caring, tough, listen, help, lead, vision, success, empowerment, citizen, activist, mobilize, conflict, light, dream, freedom, peace, rights, pioneer, proud, pride, building, preserve, pro-flag, pro-children, pro-environment, reform, eliminate good time in prison, strength, choose, choice, fair, protect, confident, incentive, hard work, initiative, common sense, passionate. One of the things that you want to avoid is doing what John Kerry did in so many of his conversations during the 2004 election. And that is using 15 or 16 words, particularly words that are polysyllabic, you know, multiple syllables, and largely abstractions, to describe something that you can describe in three or four words that are really simple.
Well, we need to carefully consider the long-term strategic consequences of any bilateral, or excuse me, of any unilateral participation in a conflict in that part of the world. That's not a verbatim quote. It's a, you know, I'm imagining it, for example. But you know what I'm talking about. When instead he could have said something like, we shouldn't just invade another country. We should bring our allies with us and get the consensus of the world, or get the world to agree. Because the simpler words are more effective at creating the pictures. There's not as much processing necessary. This is this whole process of the processing is also, here's another example, and this is probably one of the most important examples. Consider how George Bush used the coming together moment of 9/11 and turned it
into an us versus them campaign. I mean, this was a radical transformation. If you remember back to 9/11, and you remember the days immediately following it, the one or two days right after 9/11, the 12th and the 13th of September 2001, there were pictures in the paper of candlelight vigils in Tehran, Iran, in Jordan, all across Africa, all across Asia, in China, all across Europe, in South America, Central America, all over the world. People were saying, you know, the headline in Le Monde, the French newspaper, the famously, you know, Americans, the French newspaper, the headline, we're all Americans now. And George Bush could have used that powerful, iconic image that was burned into the minds of people all over the world, of the planes flying into the towers. He could have used that and associated with it. I mean, the initial association obviously was the emotion of horror. Then came the emotion of community, because that's our instinct as human beings, is to form community. We could have created worldwide community around that. But instead, he and his advisors, very carefully, very methodically, very strategically, in my opinion, instead created the emotion of us versus them, of hatred and fear, of anger. Because those are the emotions that George W. Bush is most comfortable with, and those are the emotions that can be used most easily to manipulate people. That's the survival level. That's the limbic brain. Instead, it could have been a healing moment, like JFK after the Cuban Missile Crisis, or Abraham Lincoln after the Civil War. At the end of the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln saying neither party expected for the war the magnitude or the duration for which it has already attained. Both read the same Bible and pray to the same God. He said, with malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to the right, to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan. 45 minutes past the hour.
Too many secrets, too many lies, got no good reasons and no alibis. Why are we at war and why do they die? Tell us you're sorry and then say goodbye. We won't gloat or treat you bad. Give you hard times like we had. But we'll learn the truth. Cause voters turned the Congress. Voters made the Congress.
See, now there's a submodality shift for you, moving from one color to another. And now a couple of questions have come up, folks in the chat room. One person, Mary Sue, says, does Barbara need an anchor for that change, that emotional change in that memory? No, once the story has changed, and that's the key, once the storyline to a memory has changed, then the memory actually is residing in a different physical part of the brain, and it has found a new home. And it's found a new home that the entire brain thinks is more useful. Basically what I was doing, and then the second question is there an order to those submodality shifts that you're doing? You know, should I push it farther away? Should I make it black and white? Should I put it off to the side? Should I run the movie backwards? Should I put donkey? You know, there are literally thousands of things that you can do to the submodality sets. It's limited only by your imagination. And there is no particular order or sequence. I was using the big ones, whether it's color or black and white, where the location is, whether it's a movie or not, running movies backwards. They're the big ones that are the easiest to use, and they have the most rapid response. But even subtle ones, like changing the contrast, making something slightly fuzzy, graying it out a little bit, seeing it through fog, things like that, all of those will change a picture. Or changing the sound, making the sound stereo, putting the sound behind you, putting the picture in front of you. There's just no limit to what you can do. The point is that as you are changing the submodality, keep in mind, different parts of the brain, literally, physically, I mean, you could actually see these changes on steady state EEG scans. As you access different parts of the brain by moving the memory around, different parts of the brain have different resources. They have different ways of dealing with things. And so, you know, if you want to heal a negative memory, then by doing this, what happens is, you know, somewhere along the line, that memory in Barbara's mind passed through a part of her brain where there was a resource, some skill or experience that said, I know how to fix this. I know how to change how you think about this. And it just did it. And you know that it did it when the story changes, and that's what she said at the very end. So to answer those two questions. Now, how did George W. Bush change the story of, we have been hit by a couple of crazies, by a small group of crazy people? Because that was the initial story. This was not a Pearl Harbor. This was not a nation with whom we were at war. This was a small band. It turned out there were fewer than 5,000 people in Al-Qaeda at the time. We've been hit by a small group of crazies, criminals. And a few of them, you know, pulled this thing off with box cutters. It was weird. It was an anomaly. And the whole world is horrified by them and has turned against them. And we can now use the police services of the world to hunt them down like they did with the Bader-Meinhof gang in Germany, or like they did with the Red Brigades in Italy when they killed Aldo Moro, the former prime minister, stuck him in a trunk and he died. Everybody turned against them. Everybody had turned against Al-Qaeda. How did suddenly Al-Qaeda get flipped around? Well, Bush used language that evoked emotions and then attached that language to 9/11 over and over and over again. Here, for example, this is just a little clip from his speech at the Republican National Convention. Here he is talking to his people. And this just, you know, random clips in the order that they were said, just pulled out, you know, impact words pulled out of his RNC speech. This is his acceptance speech at the RNC.
Be afraid, September the 11th. We saw tragedy arrive on a quiet morning. The evil terrorists, danger, doomed killers. Be afraid. The world will drift toward tragedy. May God bless you. Evil God, Iraq, darkness. The continuing danger of terrorism. Be afraid. We have fought the terrorists across the earth. Evil. We are staying on the offensive, striking terrorists abroad, and nothing will hold us back. And we will prevail. Be afraid. God bless America. Nuclear weapons. Iraq was a gathering threat, and Al-Qaeda was largely unchallenged as it planned attacks. Free Afghanistan terror. Pakistan terrorists. Saudi Arabia. Libya weapons programs. Saddam Hussein terror. Weapons of mass destruction. The Almighty God. The dictator. Afghanistan terrorists of Afghanistan and Iraq. Fight terrorists. Various terrorist enemies we are facing in Iraq. We are defeating the terrorists doing battle in Afghanistan and Iraq. The resurrection, Saddam Hussein's secret police, sadistic punishment, mass graves, radical ideology of hate, kill the innocent, tyranny and terror.
There you go. I mean, that's 1 minute, 10 seconds of a compression of Bush's speech before the RNC. And you get it, that this kind of language is all very evocative. He's pulling up pictures in our minds. He's establishing a place for those pictures and anchoring them to that experience of 9/11. Tragically. So what could have been a healing moment for the United States and the world, and actually was in the first few days, and if you think back to the first couple days after 9/11, it was this healing moment, actually. It's like, wow, we've all been wounded. We are a community. We, the world, even, has been turned into this bizarre excuse to spy on people, to do away with habeas corpus, to strip out human rights, to torture people for extraordinary rendition, to take American citizens like Jose Padilla and break them. It's, you know, so you can see the power of this. Coming up next week, on Monday, I'll be debating conservative Jim Dorn on China, the trade partner and emerging threat. Robert Fisk is dropping by on his article, Echoes of the Roman Empire, and John Swinney from the AFL-CIO is here about flawed trade deals. So stick around, and don't ever forget, my friends, activism begins with you, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.